Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Twilight of the Elites, Prosperity, the Periphery, and the Future of France, by Christophe Guillouis, translated by Malcolm de Beauvoise, narrated by Roger Clark. Introduction. Amid a fanfare of Republican self-congratulation, France has embraced globalization in all its glory. Wherever one looks, from the chronic alternation between traditional parties of the center-left and center-right to the denial of democracy itself, with the farcical referendum of 2005 on a European constitution, it is plain to see that France has become an American society, like all the rest, inegalitarian and multicultural. In the space of a few decades, the implacable law of global markets has asserted its authority everywhere, replacing a society founded on egalitarian ideals by a polarized society, seething with tensions of every sort beneath a placid surface. The unprecedented social and cultural disruption provoked by this sudden swing has until now been covered up by a patriotic blast of trumpets. But this Republican fanfare, though it grows louder and louder, rings ever more false with the passage of time. As in all the other developed countries, the new economic order does not cease sowing division and discord. How could things have changed so quickly? How could a dominant class, by definition minuscule, have managed to impose an economic model that no one, and especially not the working classes, had chosen? How was this model able to win acceptance so easily, when criticism of a system run by bankers and the wealthy oligarchs they are assumed to serve is a commonplace of intellectual commentary and political debate? All of this was possible in the first place because the dominant class is supported by a large segment of society, namely all those who gain from globalization or who are protected against its adverse consequences. These people, though they themselves need not be either rich or owners of capital, make up a crucial part of what I call the higher France. This privileged stratum consists of not only the country's elites and traditional upper classes, but also the new bourgeoisie that supports them, without whose aid nothing could have been done. Together, they bear responsibility for economic and social policies that have plunged a majority of the working class into a kind of insecurity it had not previously known. They are agreed in placing the nation's economy on a new territorial basis, metropolization, that has the effect of banishing the least well-off members of society to the periphery, condemned to live out their lives as second-class citizens. Globalization has revived the citadels of medieval France. No longer walled cities, they are now modern cities in which a new class that captures most of the benefits of offshore production and free trade is concentrated. Workers in the developed countries, excluded from a broader economy based on an international division of labor in which they no longer have a place, being relatively overpaid and underprotected, find themselves relegated to a lower France, the France of small and medium-sized towns and rural areas. Everywhere, from peripheral France, the part of the country that rejected the European Union by voting no in the 2005 referendum, to peripheral Britain, the land of Brexit, from peripheral America, the land of Trump, to peripheral Sweden, the vanguard of the European alt-right, and beyond. Economic globalization arouses the same spirit of populist revolt. It is owing to this very spirit that the higher France now finds itself in grave danger of losing control over the lower. The Maastricht Treaty of 1992 was the first shot across the bow. the referendum of 2005, the second. The existing order will finally break down not as the result of some decisive event. It will break down as the result of a slow process of social and cultural disaffiliation on the part of the working class. The political class, in the broadest sense, not only politicians, but cultural leaders, intellectuals, and journalists, now begins to dread the prospect of a modern slave rebellion, for a new form of class conflict, which had long been assumed not to exist, is now plain for all to see. 1. The New Citadels. The medieval citadels are back. In the globalized metropolises, a new kind of bourgeoisie has taken power, without hatred or violence. Wealth, jobs, and political and cultural power have been unobtrusively seized. Although the great divide in French society is often described as a confrontation between elites and the people, the system rests not only on elites, but also on a very sizable fraction of the population, a new upper middle class, which lives mainly in the major cities and which has supported the economic policies of the upper class for 30 years now. Unlike the old bourgeoisie, its successors understand that economic and cultural domination will be all the more effective as it is exercised in the name of the common good and openness. From Bordeaux to Lyon to Paris, the new bourgeoisie votes for centre-left or centre-right candidates representing the global economy and resides for the most part in the 15 largest urban centres of France. Disguised as hipsters, the new gentrifiers busy themselves scrambling for the spoils left over from the modern-day hunt, which is to say, the plundering of French society through the imposition of a new economic order, the Anglo-Saxon model of globalization. This radical change was accomplished with little public protest or dissent by means of a contrived opposition between the enlightened and forward-looking champions of an open society and the blinkered defenders of the past, who call on France to take refuge behind closed borders. The voice of the working class, now associated with the camp of withdrawal, became inaudible. The dominant classes, for their part, having now at last disposed of the social question, were free to impose their view of the world in the name of modernity, openness, even equality. After several decades during which the economic and social landscape has been quietly reconfigured, the higher France now lives undisturbed in the safety of its new citadels. If global metropolises are the most visible evidence of this state of affairs, their invisible ramparts, the social and cultural supremacy of the new bourgeoisie, illustrate still more plainly the tendency to associate with one's own kind, known as self-segregation. Behind the myth of the open and egalitarian society of the cosmopolitan urban centres, then, we are witnessing the return of the closed towns of the Middle Ages, and the consolidation of an inegalitarian model of the Anglo-Saxon type. This reality is obscured by the manufacture of a consensual and positive understanding of the benefits of metropolisation, accruing from the concentration of economic productivity in 15 major French cities, which themselves may be thought of as constituting a networked society. In singing the praises of diversity, while at the same time establishing a system marked by deep social and economic inequalities, the dominant classes are able to conceal the bonds of fellowship that unite the beneficiaries of globalization. The roots of a conflict among classes that no one dares mention, and the latent tensions that are bound to emerge in a multicultural nation. For in these metropolitan areas, it is not only patrimony, wealth, and jobs that have been confiscated. It is here that a single way of thinking and talking about these things has been conceived. The discourse of a political system, and of the media outlets that interpret it for popular consumption, that allows the dominant classes to substitute for the reality of a nation subject to severe stresses and strains the fable of a kind and welcoming society. It should be obvious that France is not the land of fraternité it pretends to be, but reality no longer matters. Devoid of all collective attachment except membership in its own club, the new bourgeoisie merrily surfs the surging waves of the market, reinforcing its class position, capturing the economic benefits of globalization, and building up a portfolio of real estate holdings that soon will rival that of the old bourgeoisie. Notwithstanding the protection afforded by the neo-medieval citadels, the executives of the Higher France have not retreated from the world. Far from it, the new bourgeoisie openly presides over cultural and political life in the name of the common good and racial unity. Unlike the old bourgeoisie, which was unable to abolish class conflict, it has managed to persuade itself, if no one else, that the ideal of a society without class interests or divisions, what it likes to call living together in harmony, is suddenly within reach. In advocating free trade and cultural diversity, it has helped its masters to raise barriers that are no less effective in keeping out the masses than those of the old regime. The lie of the open society. The bourgeoisie used to stand for class loyalty, self-segregation, rejection of outsiders, refusal of progress. That was then. Today, it no longer locks itself away in its own private world. Professing to believe that social and cultural mixing is a necessity, fully consonant with republican values, its members are more than happy to march alongside their fellow citizens for change. In reality, though, self-segregation and networking have never been practiced more enthusiastically. Today's amiable go-getters participate directly or indirectly in the vital process of demoting the working class through economic and social policies that exclude the less well-off from the places that really matter, the large cities where most jobs are created. The looting of the private housing stock of the major urban centres, formerly occupied by the working class, has no equivalent in the nation's history. What is more, all this is taking place with a minimum of fuss and on an expanding scale. Without the legitimacy of such dispossession ever being questioned, still less seriously objected to, unsurprisingly perhaps, since the preponderance of the dominant classes in the places where jobs and wealth are created for the most part is also accompanied by the growing influence of these same classes over public debate. The social and geographical gregariousness of the dominant classes goes hand in hand with an intellectual gregariousness that stifles genuine discussion. From the concentration of the winners from globalization in areas of the country having something like a monopoly over wealth and job creation, there arises a uniform style of thinking and speaking, an edifying discourse of benign globalization and metropolization broadcast by the media and repeated by the political class that looks to them for direction. It is futile, then, to expect that any meaningful referendum will one day be held on globalization, on Europe, on free trade agreements, or on the reform of local governments in France. The upper classes swear only by the network, whether the virtual network of the internet or the physical network of the major cities. It allows them to furtively justify the relegation of the lower classes by persuading people that living in somewhere like Cantal, one of the most isolated regions in France, is really no different than living in New York, that career opportunities in small towns and large cities are identical, because in each place one is equally connected. All the vague talk about interconnectedness, mobility, trade, social diversity, openness to others, and so on, is a way of obscuring the effects of unequal economic development and a form of regional organization that shuts out most of the less well-off from the large cities. The myth of networked mobility propagated by the media and an intelligentsia with a vested interest in metropolization is cleverly deployed to mask the seizure of wealth. On the one hand, there is the virtual network, a snare and a delusion for the working poor. On the other, there is the real network of their masters, which efficiently connects wealth with a common self-interest. In taking up residence in the major European cities and the regional centres of France, corporate executives and their counterparts in the academy and the liberal professions consciously or unconsciously endorse a strategy of social ghettoisation. The same strategy is applied in the mixed neighbourhoods of large cities, where exclusive apartment buildings for the upper class and private schools for their children are the norm. If certain cultural and political differences still make it possible to distinguish between a new and an old bourgeoisie, both subscribe to the same economic model. However much they may appear to disagree on social questions, both profit from a global economy and its corollary, metropolization. Sheltered behind the reassuring rhetoric of modernity, openness, and peaceful coexistence, the dominant classes play an active role in impoverishing the lives of a majority of the working class by removing them from the country's economic and cultural centres. In view of the ongoing concentration of wealth and power in the great cities, and the influence of these cities over regional politics and the press, most politicians and media outlets protect the interests of the areas having these cities as their administrative seat, advocates for rural populations, for the small and medium-sized cities and their surrounding departments, have little chance of making themselves heard, and this all the more as the dominant classes are able to achieve their purposes under cover of euphemism. The upper classes call for equality among the nation's regions, while at the same time promoting metropolization and gentrification, they demand greater social diversity, but separate themselves from the lower classes by living apart from them. They urge everyone to get along, but create a ghettoized educational system in which the children of the poor have no choice but to go to public schools that their own children are able to avoid. They uphold republican principles, and none more resolutely than the principle of equality, but in reality favor inegalitarianism. The predicament presently facing France is therefore misleadingly imagined to pit supporters of an open society against the supporters of a closed society. On the one side are the new moderns, those who are intelligent enough to perceive the direction of history and generous enough to teach their fellow citizens to see the world as they do. On the other are the new ancients, the backward-looking, the unqualified, the weak-minded, the uneducated. This way of putting the matter obscures two things. The first is that this ideological divide is, at bottom, a social divide between the upper classes, who gain from globalization, and the lower classes, who lose from it. The second is that the social question has been concealed by a concerted attempt for several decades now to legitimize the economic advantages enjoyed by the upper classes. The open society, closed society cleavage effectively places the upper classes in a position of moral superiority. Any critique of the existing socio-economic system is interpreted as evidence of an attitude favoring retreat and withdrawal from the world that recalls the dark days of the 1930s. In this little game, the working poor are bound to lose. The political failure of the opponents of economic globalism, from the extreme left to the extreme right, is proof of the effectiveness of calculated cynicism. The success of this strategy is all the more perverse as the open, diverse, egalitarian society that is so much talked about in no way corresponds to reality, and still less to what the upper classes actually want. A globalized society is a closed society in which the combined effects of class inbreeding, residential separatism, educational apartheid, and a selfish determination to accumulate wealth and property have never been so powerful. The picture presented by the fairy tale that has been told over and over again for 20 years now by the media, in which the good do battle against the wicked, could not be more false. French society is not divided between enlightened partisans of progress and their uncultivated and blinkered adversaries. The true divide is between those who stand to gain from globalization, or at least have the means to protect themselves against occasional misfortune, and those who stand to lose from globalization, who are powerless to withstand its merciless onslaught. Behind all the talk about openness, there is a different and rather less comforting reality, the self-ghettoization of the dominant classes, a strengthened system of social reproduction, and the advent of an oligarchic political system whose outstanding feature is the habitual alternation between traditional parties of the left and the right that I mentioned at the outset. By fostering globalism and multiculturalism, the elites have been able surreptitiously to bring about the emergence of a profoundly inegalitarian system, tearing down a system of social protections that has finally outlived its usefulness. The elites and the privileged classes that support them are well aware that a globalized and multicultural society is viable only on the condition that they can protect themselves from the tensions it unavoidably generates, social tensions arising from a future without any hope of economic prosperity for the working class, and cultural tensions arising from a society that has now acquired multiple identities. The guarantees that the elites seek cannot come from a welfare state weakened by neoliberal economic and social policies. They can only come from a strengthening of class self-segregation and systematic avoidance of the lower classes in daily life. Having no real desire to live together, since living together with someone who makes 1,000 euros a month, or about $14,000 a year, would mean actually seeing this person in one's own apartment building, meeting him or her on the way to work, sending one's children to the same schools as his or her children, and so on. The dominant classes piously accuse those who lack the means to protect themselves of being responsible for these very tensions. The discourse of openness to the world and benign regard for people of different backgrounds may now be seen for what it is, a smokescreen devised to conceal the emergence of a closed and isolated society whose greatest beneficiaries are the upper classes themselves. The impregnable fortresses erected in the name of economic rationality, so that the upper classes will be assured of having the lion's share of wealth and jobs, are surrounded by stronger and more imposing ramparts than the curtain walls of medieval castles. For the walls of money that divide peripheral France from the major cities make it possible to keep out the plebeians much more effectively than in the past. The metropolises of the present day provide public housing in outlying districts for the underpaid immigrant workers, who supply cheap labour for the metropolitan economy, thereby helping to sustain the artificial image of an open city. 60% of immigrants in France today live in these banlieues of the 15 largest cities. It will be clear, then, that the fashionable globalism of the major urban centres has won. It has brought us back to the Middle Ages. In the space of a few decades, a new bourgeoisie, secure in its gentrified redoubts, has expropriated the common inheritance of the nation: jobs, wealth, political and cultural power. What is more, this seizure has been covertly achieved with the aid of deceitful rhetoric that conceals its true consequences. Class domination must remain invisible. Working-class France must likewise be unseen, and the upper class lumped together in the popular mind with the middle class. The hysterical reaction of academics and the media in France to the term bourgeois bohemian or bobo, which reintroduces a class relation between newcomers from the upper and or intellectual classes and members of the traditional working class, some of immigrant descent, betrays their determination to hide the confiscation by the elites, not only of a patrimony that formerly belonged to the working classes, but also of most of the benefits of globalization. Hipsters at the gate. If previous generations of the bourgeoisie lusted after money and power in more nakedly opportunistic ways, the boboized upper classes embody the laid-back style of domination in the 21st century. Like its predecessor, though, the new bourgeoisie instigates and supports the great economic, social, cultural, and urban transformations of its time, and again for its own benefit. The upper classes today have seen their income and economic power increase with the spread of market deregulation throughout the world. The real estate holdings they have accumulated are every bit the equal in value of the townhouses of the industrial bourgeoisie of the 19th century. But with this difference, there is nothing at all ostentatious about today's bourgeoisie. Its members live in what was once workers' housing, in old factories and commercial buildings converted into lofts, in what they persist in calling working-class neighbourhoods. This is a very big difference. Indeed, the central aspect of the new form of domination. Today's bourgeoisie is the antithesis of yesterday's, at least in the sense that its members have understood that their interests will be defended not through class struggle, but through the blurring of class divisions. It is precisely in order to assist this confusion that the use of the term bobo is frowned on by the very people whom it identifies as bourgeois. The new bourgeoisie has not displaced the traditional bourgeoisie and the wealthiest families, who still live in their traditional neighbourhoods. Instead, it has expanded into all those areas formerly occupied by the middle and working classes. No longer obliged to wage old wars, the new bourgeoisie quickly grasped the importance of adopting a new look. The election in the big cities of candidates from the centre-right and centre-left neatly completed the picture of a hip upper-middle class devoted to a new concept of urbanism, and a particularly agreeable way of life, wholesome, healthy, and environmentally friendly. Paris, the seat of all economic and cultural power, where real estate prices are the highest in the country, is now a bastion of the left. Although it is the richest city in France, with the highest proportion of executives and white-collar managers, 43% of the local workforce, more of its elected officials come from the ranks of the Socialist Party than anywhere in the country, more even than in the historically working-class northern region. Paris is home, in other words, to the highest stage of the new capitalism, a cool capitalism that offers all the advantages of a market economy without any of the inconveniences of a class struggle. Posing as protesters at the...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?